history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories out there that need to be told, and we'll never hear them unless we take a little bit of time to ask some questions and listen to what comes back our way. We want to honor our veterans for their service and the sacrifices they've made. We really want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today, I'm in Los Gatos, California, with 93, almost 94-year-old, Bill Venuti, originally from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, the son of Italian-American immigrants. What was that childhood like there in Philly, Bill?
It was very unusual, entirely different than how my children grew up. We lived in a neighborhood where there were all Italian immigrants. In Philadelphia, there are these neighborhoods that stick together. And in my part of the city, there were sections that were Irish, and there were Italians, and there were Jewish people, and Polish, and so on. And we had our own neighborhoods. And my street was all Italians, all Italian families, most of them immigrants. And so that's how I grew up. And no parks, that all our recreational activities were in the street. And we made up our own games, football and baseball and so on. In baseball, we used a like a half ball, like a tennis ball cut in half. And that was our ball, and the bat was a broomstick handle. And for football, we couldn't afford a football. Didn't even know what one looked like. So we made our own by just wrapping up newspaper and tying it as our football. Our recreational activities was in the street.
And you mentioned not being able to afford a football. I mean, this is the Great Depression, and those of us living today probably have a hard time fathoming the way things were back then.
Yes.
And you mentioned not being able to afford a football. I mean, this is the Great Depression, and those of us living today probably have a hard time fathoming the way things were back then.
Yes.
What do you look back on and say those were the biggest differences or the starkest contrast?
Well, there's a world of difference between how I grew up and how my children grew up. Entirely different. There we were in an area where there were all people like us, all Italians. So I get to know the families, and most of the Italians who came from Italy couldn't speak English. And many times they could not communicate with each other because of the dialect. There were a number of dialects in Italy. But all the kids I played with were Italian kids like myself. So it was in the street where we played.
And I've met a lot of Italians in your age range and people who grew up during that Great Depression. And whether they had a lot or a little, I think every Italian-American veteran who I've interviewed talks about the food his mother used to make. Did your mom have a specialty of that Italian cuisine?
The popular dish is pasta and meatballs and bracciola. So, and a big meal would be on Sunday, of course. My mother would, of course, we go to church every Sunday morning, and my mother would put this large pot of pasta sauce on a stove, had it simmer for an hour and a half, we're in church and come back. And of course, you know what bracciola is? You put bracciola in there, and that would be cooking, then come back and then do the pasta, and we'd have a pretty big meal. That was our biggest meal of the week. As I recall, we also had pasta on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And Friday was, of course, fish day because Friday, you didn't want to eat meat. Of course, it was sinful. Anyway, so that was how we had our meals. The house we lived in was very small, the row house. On our street, there were 25 houses on each side of the street, over the common wall, and so we got to know the neighbors pretty well. But the house were pretty well built because they had brick walls, and you can't hear anybody from next door, except if they were in the backyard. So the house was quite small, and we had two bedrooms and one bathroom and a basement. At one time, we didn't have any hot water heater, so in order to take a bath, which the bathtub was upstairs, the bathroom, we'd have to put a big pan of water on a stove in the kitchen and carry it up and hope you don't trip and burn yourself to death.
That does sound a lot different from what your kids and your grandkids, I'm sure, have experienced. But back then, I'm sure you weren't thinking about kids or grandkids. You're thinking, what am I going to do when I grow up? Do you remember some dreams or ambitions you had as a child?
I played the drums at that time, wanted to be a drummer. I played with some small groups, but never got anywhere with it. That was one of my ambitions. In high school, I had no idea what I wanted to do. In high school, I was in what they call an industrial program, and they also had other programs which were more academic. In industrial programs, most of our class were in shops, like wood shop or metal shop or whatever, welding. So did a lot of that. So when I graduated from high school, I worked for a year. The war had just started. As a matter of fact, the war started when I graduated. I graduated in January 42. Anyway, so I heard Roosevelt give us a speech.
Well, let's talk about that, because I've yet to meet a veteran who doesn't remember something about how he or she found out about the Pearl Harbor attack. What do you remember about that?
Well, I remember it was a Sunday. I was walking down the street, and somehow I heard a radio program coming from one of the houses with an open window about the Japanese having attacked Pearl Harbor. And I had no idea where Pearl Harbor was or that I would end up in the Navy and being Pearl Harbor. But anyway, so I didn't know my geography that well. Anyway, so I worked for a year in a machine shop and decided to join the Navy. Otherwise, I would have been drafted into the Army. So that's how I got into the Navy. And went to boot camp for, I think it was 2 months or so. I was playing the drums. I wanted to join the U.S. Navy Band, which is stationed in Washington. There was a chief petty officer who was named Charlie Bassetti, Italian name, who was also a drummer. He was the teacher of Gene Krupa. You know the drummer Gene Krupa?
Sure.
Yeah. So I got to meet him. He gave me an examination what to do in the drums. He said, you're not good enough for the U.S. Navy Band, but I'll send you to San Diego. It was a program where they took the draftees who were musicians. These were guys from various named bands and formed band groups. And they would be assigned to large ships and different naval bases around the world. So I said, I'll send you there. So that was a good deal for me. I still wasn't good enough. These guys who were there were from named bands or great drummers.
And when you say named bands, you mean the people that you might hear on the radio or that play in concerts at different places, the bands that you were familiar with?
Tom Dorsey and Artie Shaw and Gene Krupa and those bands. Yes, They were the swing bands at the time. We'd have about 16 pieces, and they would put on performances. They would travel around the country, and I remember going to theaters where they would be performing. Anyway, so these drummers were very good, and so I did not stay there very long. So I was sent to Pearl Harbor, and I was asked what kind of ship I wanted to be put on. So thinking it'd be safer to be on a battleship, so I selected a battleship. And lo and behold, they gave me the USS North Carolina.
Which would be the most decorated battleship of World War II with 15 battle stars. But when you say you think it would be safe to be on a battleship, you also just said you were at Pearl Harbor. And on December 7th at Pearl Harbor, the battleship Arizona is sunk. The battleship Oklahoma is sunk. The battleships like the West Virginia and the Tennessee and the Pennsylvania are all damaged. So did you really think a battleship was going to be safe?
Well, I compared it to smaller ships like destroyers. I thought that the bigger the ship, the safer it would be. And lo and behold, they gave me a battleship, too. That happened even before I was in San Francisco at the time, and they gave me this questionnaire, and I filled it out. I selected a battleship, and lo and behold, they said I can be assigned to a battleship. So went from San Francisco to Pearl Harbor and onto the battleship. North Carolina was doing active duty at the time, but they had been torpedoed, but that was repaired sometime before this time they were in Pearl Harbor. But it was in dry dock, and they had to repair the rudder and the steering apparatus. Anyway, so it was in dry dock. It was being repaired, so I was in Pearl Harbor for about a month before they filled up the dry dock and sailed out of there. So that was it.
Well, and I'm curious, you're at Pearl Harbor, you said, for a month. Did you have a chance to see or take in any of the aftermath, the evidence of what had happened there? Were there signs still there of what had happened back in December of 41?
Yes, I had a chance to. Of course, it wasn't only the ships that were damaged. The airfield was pretty well destroyed, too. So I went to see some of the ships and the air base, and some of the destroyed planes were still there. when I got there. This was in 42, so just a year afterwards.
You went over to Hickam Field?
Yes, right, Hickam Field, that's right. So I did that. And it's real easy to get there. I didn't pay bus or anything because you hitchhike, and with a uniform, people would pick you up. So it worked out pretty well.
Did that stir anything in you? Was that impactful to see with your own eyes in person as opposed to a newspaper or hearing it on the radio that this is what this enemy, Imperial Japan, has done to the U.S.?
I was 18 years old. I didn't think about that at all. I just knew that I'd be doing my duty by serving in the Navy, and that was it. So I was on the ship for just one night before they assigned me to the division that I stayed in for the time I was on the ship. They issue a hammock, which you carry around with you. I stayed in the hammock only one night. That was the first night on the ship. And then they sent me to the lookout division. I was a lookout, but they had bunks, four deep, so on. So I was in the lookout division all that time. But the good thing about being a lookout division is that there were two or three different battle stations where lookouts would be. And mine was at the top of the ship, they call Sky Control. And you can see all around, so it was interesting place to be as far as seeing all the activity during the invasions and Japanese planes coming in and so on. So I saw quite a bit of that. Five of the major battles I was in. The first one, the Gilbert Islands and the Marshall Islands, Truk and New Guinea.
Well, and I want to hear about what you saw in those circumstances, because you did have a unique vantage point that most of the 2,000 plus guys on your ship wouldn't have seen. But you mentioned that when you got on the ship at Pearl, it was in dry dock getting repaired because it had been torpedoed by the Japanese. Did that bother you at all? Did that question the confidence you had in this ship? It's already been banged up a little bit?
It received one torpedo and five men were killed. This was about maybe 4 or 5 months before I got in the ship. And I didn't think that was all that bad. I thought I'd be safer at the top of the ship than being below the waterline. And being a lookout, of course, I saw all the activity. Maybe one-third of the crew were below with the main decks and couldn't see anything at all. So I was in a real good position, too. And I just enjoyed doing it, too, because I was scared at first. They're the first Japanese attacker. You just don't know if you're going to be killed or not. And so, but then one gets used to it and just think of doing your duty as a lookout and reporting where the explosions were, where the Japanese planes were, and so on. We sometimes have practices, too, and then sometimes a real thing. Before the battle begins, there's an announcement throughout the entire ship that all hands man your battle station, man your battle stations. Then there's a signal going boom, 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 boom. And from that point, wherever you are, you have to get to your battle station. And most of the time, I was in my quarters, which is one deck below the main deck. So I had to run from there to the top of the ship in about 1 minute, no hesitation at all. Uh-huh. Sometimes climb the ladder on the outside of the conning tower, then into the battle station. At the battle station where I was, it was called Sky Control. The front part had what they called alidades, or four of them. It's a contraption where you sit down in a seat and you have handlebars and you swing around horizontally so you can see different areas. And of course, the handlebars are such that you have binoculars on the end that can go up and down so they can see whatever you want. So that's my battle station. There were four of us, and then there was an officer who would guide us and also relate what we saw to the bridge and so on.
Well, you mentioned the first time you had to deal with a battle situation. You gave us a little sense of what that felt like. Can you walk us through that step by step, though? What you're looking for, where, what you're seeing, what's going through your mind that first time you encountered the enemy?
I have to back up and tell you that we had 102 ships in our fleet, 102 ships. Of course, the main ship was the aircraft carriers, which did the bombarding and try to shoot down the Japanese planes. So there were eight carriers and in the middle of the array of ships, then a circle of battleships, eight battleships. North was one of them. And then around the circle of battleships were heavy cruisers, then light cruisers, then destroyers, 102 ships in all. The first battle that I was in was in Gilbert Islands. This was one of the first major invasions, too. Of course, the Japanese were coming there, so they prepared for that, and sometimes there'd be submarines in the area. So in order to avoid being hit by a torpedo, the path we would take as we are moving along at high speed, which is about 33 miles an hour, we have a zigzag pattern. So all ships would have to go in one direction for 3 or 4 minutes, then another direction, a random direction. And of course, each ship had to be right on, otherwise there'd be collisions. And once there was a collision, Anyway, that was our mode of operation. But it was fascinating seeing from sky control where I was all these ships and the movements and so on. And, of course, occasionally it'd be Japanese in a year or two and it'd be sending their torpedoes in different directions. So as a lookout, I would have to indicate where there was a torpedo wake and relay that to the officer, and the officers were sent down to the bridge. But a typical battle would be we would be preparing to bombard and then invade the islands, like Gilbert and Marshall Islands and other places. But anyway, so the order of operation would be to send the heavy ships, but I guess all of them would circle the islands, and the heavy ships would bombard the Japanese islands. And my job would be to indicate where the hits were, where the large explosions were. It was quite common to see a building with a big Red Cross on, indicating it was a hospital. But they realized that it was not a hospital. It was where they kept their armament. So I've had to point out where that was located and where the explosions were. That would take place first. That would be one day. Then the following day, the invasion would take place.
Well, I've got to ask you, I'm listening to you and I'm imagining myself in your shoes, and it actually kind of sounds like what I do a lot. I go to sporting events and describe the play-by-play of what's happening. It sounds like you had to give a little play-by-play of the battle, but what's your frame of reference when you say I have to say where the shells are hitting? Did you have a grid? Are you just using, you know, compass directions? How do you describe and pass on that information so it's accurate?
Well, I had a view of the entire island. Maybe not, but most of the island. And I would indicate what part of the island the large explosions took place. And I would never see the troops land out came afterwards. So that was my job. And also indicate where there were torpedo wakes and where they were heading, and so the ships couldn't avoid them.
I'm sure as you listen today, you can imagine what that felt like. But we're going to explore more of Bill Venuti's World War II story when we come back. And there are some twists and turns his journey has taken since World War II that I think you're going to enjoy hearing about as well. Find photos of Bill then and now at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.